Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 510. In this episode, Scott talks with enterprise developer turned tech CEO Tiffany Michael about the challenges and rewards of software development in a startup.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm chatting with Tiffany Michael. She's a CEO of BSM.co. And you're building an online system for conferences, education.
Absolutely. So the short tagline right now for BSM.co is we build customizable social broadcast spaces. And where our focus currently is on education, but there are a lot of other use cases and markets that we're looking towards exploring.
And you did some virtual conferences that got a lot of great press that allowed people to basically attend and be present and be social without having to get on a plane.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, we held our first virtual conference, early 2015. It started because we were doing a series of virtual courses, for entrepreneurs and technologists of color. We appreciated, the virtual remote learning, landscape, and we felt like, we could add to that as technologists and creators. And so we started very simple using Google Hangouts, and we realized really quickly the limitations of Google Hangouts as it relates to creating a engaging learning environment. And so we started kind of looking at other tools. We thought at the time that we would be in the content creation space. And so not the technology, software development space at all. And so we started evaluating other tools. A lot of the tools were built on top of the Google Hangout infrastructure. There were a lot of other tools that required downloads of software, such as Adobe's Connect system, and nothing that really worked for us. And so we used a CMS and JavaScript and hacked together a virtual conference center. And we thought it would be a one-time thing, but speakers and attendees of the conference were in awe and really blown away by how engaging it was, how much fun they had on the platform, that they were able to communicate with both the speakers in real time and other attendees. And that was kind of our biggest moment of validation as a startup, when we really started to realize that we had finally built something that people wanted to pay for. And so we've been exploring how to build virtual learning tools for the last year.
Very cool. One of the things that I liked the most about it when I was attending one of the conferences virtually is that you effectively captured what we call the hallway track, right? I mean, we all go to conferences and sometimes we just skip a talk and we just want to hang out with people. That there was a sense of we're all in this together, as opposed to the I'm watching a static stream. I'm just watching a stream.
Absolutely. And one of the things as we begin to build out the software and think about how we are unique and different from others, who are similar players in the space, we feel like we're one of the few, people in the remote learning space who really care about the overall experience of the learner. It's not really about just converting them into buy something, but really, are they speaking with other people? Are they having positive interactions with other people who are watching, and using technology to enable those experiences?
Right. That makes me feel like the difference between selling technology versus really selling an experience, and technology is in this case secondary.
Absolutely.
So what I think is interesting about your story and why I wanted to talk to you is there's a couple things that you're doing that I can totally relate to. First, you were an enterprise software developer. So, I mean, how big was the company you worked at before?
Sure. So I was at Accenture for 5 years. So some of the clients I had, my last client was PepsiCo. huge company. Everybody mm-hmm. knows who Pepsi is. I did a lot of big government projects. So a big Oracle implementation for the Air Force. Did a big custom application for Illinois' unemployment office. So really big, huge projects.
And now, how many developers do you have helping you?
One. We have it's myself and one other developer.
That has got to be like a huge change. It's got to be a culture shock even.
It is. It is. It's scary and intimidating and exciting. And I am like, oh my God, I cannot believe that I have all this responsibility. and so it's been exciting. But it's definitely, I wish there were more public conversations about what it's like to go from I'm a developer on a team of 50 or 100 other developers who all have specializations in different areas to it's two of us responsible for delivering a production level app that doesn't crash. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's tough.
Well, yeah, maybe the conversation can be facilitated on your platform because I think that the people who are listening are these enterprise software developers. There's a term that I coined a couple of years ago that some people totally resonated with and other ones don't like called dark matter developers. And those are the space between the stars, right? For yep. every one developer who's out there speaking at a conference, there's 1,000 of us that are just doing our jobs and yep. going to work and building insurance software and text boxes over data. Where are the resources for us to make startups?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's tough, and especially because entrepreneurial has gotten so hot. And for, you know, because tech entrepreneurship has been so hot, there's often people want to tie learning to code with starting a business. And while those things are somewhat related, there's a whole like wide area of space that comes from I know how to write a program to I'm prepared to build something that other people will buy and take to scale. And so, yeah, I'd love to see more conversation about like, you know, one of the things that one of the big first decisions I had to make was what were we going to build in? Because I have, so I was a consultant for many years, which means, I was hired as a Java developer. I built maybe two custom apps and really it was just kind of whatever my client needed. And so I didn't get an opportunity to specialize. I played with C# a little bit. Actually, .NET is what I, VB is what I learned to program in 2006. But I had been, you know, all over the place. And so it was finally time for me to like pick a stack. And I'm like, I don't know, what is it going to be? And so because I had, you know, I appreciated the .NET framework and I had, a lot of recent experiences with C#. I'm like, okay, we're going to go the .NET C# route. And I started to try to hire C# developers, which was cool. But what I quickly realized is that rather than hiring for a specific technology that early, I needed to hire for passion in the product, and passion in what we were building. And it just so happened that I found someone who was super passionate about remote learning, the WebRTC, web real-time communication library and toolkit. And they were a Java developer. And so it just so happened that we decided to go the Java Groovy Grails route, because this person was so passionate about, the product, and we were able to grow with them. So
do you think that people overstress the need for the technology stack? Like, you know, you get into these religious arguments. There's a lot of zealotry where people are like, oh, you picked, someone might be listening right now. Oh, you picked Groovy on Grails. Oh, it's crap. You got to pick this other thing, right? Absolutely. You can't be successful now.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there are, you know, some, you know, foundational decisions that you have to make that will have implications for the next year and 2 years. But I feel like when you're in a startup, it's really just about like that minimum viable product. Like, and, how quickly can you move with that MVP? And so even if you have like the expert in some stack, if they're not passionate about like moving and moving fast, you'll go nowhere. And I think that we're still in a place where eventually we'll be able to like make some changes when we have more customers and funding and we know for sure what we're building. Mm-hmm. 'Cause right now we're still kind of figuring it out.
So not only did you have to pick a technology stack, but you also have to pick a workflow, right?
Yes.
Did you go Agile or Scrum or Waterfall or, you know, I mean, all these things, and not to mention source control. And a lot of times I found I was an enterprise developer for 7 years and I would find myself slipping into comfortable technologies, but maybe they weren't the right technology.
Absolutely. All the time. It's something I think about all the time. Yes. Yes. So, we use Bitbucket, as our, repo.
Do you use Git or SVN?
We use Git.
Okay.
I'd say we kind of have an agile, workflow, but again, it's so right now it's two of us. And so I know we have some awful habits. And it's just like, okay, we've got an event coming, like, just like get it done kind of thing. But now that we're like, okay, it's time for us to like grow up, and create an environment that other developers will want to work in. I spend so many times, a lot of time, in a day thinking about like, okay, how do I do this the right way? How do I set processes in place now that might be a pain, kind of like might feel like overkill when there's just two people, but will save our asses when there's like 10 of us.
So if it's just you and one other person, is the other person, because you're a small business, is the other person a subcontractor or are they an employee?
The other person is a subcontractor.
So do you hire, like, do you kind of like swell up and have four or five subcontractors and then you come back down when at different times?
Yeah, we're figuring that out right now. So we had two, the most we've ever had is two other people. And I guess going back to Agile, I have been like, breaking up our project into short sprints. And so I will kind of determine how many resources I need for each sprint. And there was one sprint where we had three people total. They were all subcontractors. Right now it's just me and another person.
Now your partner is, Dr. Courtney Ziegler, who I had on the show, I think a year or two ago. And, so you are the CEO. He acts as the COO.
Correct.
And, you know, he's got vision and passion and a filmmaking background and a promotional background. So he's thinking about how to raise money and things like that. But I've always found when you have, and I'll just use the kind of the Wozniak and the Steve Jobs analogy, or the Bill Gates and the Steve Ballmer kind of partners, you're going to be two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
Do you have architectural discussions with him? Does he want to get involved? And do you have like technical arguments?
Yes, absolutely. So I think in the beginning, he was a little shy about it. Like, oh my goodness, I've never built software before. I don't know if I should even be a part of these conversations. I don't know if I, you know, can add value. And I was like, yes, you were really, really important to these conversations. Because what I found is when just developers in the room, the conversation can go different ways. The conversation can go, okay, what's the easiest way to do this? What's the technology that I actually want to use? What do I care about as a developer versus, what do the customers, what do our users actually want to see? And so Courtney has absolutely always brings the voice of our users in. He has a design background and so always wants things to be really elegant, really easy to use and intuitive. I think what developers define as intuitive is sometimes different than what everybody else defines as intuitive. So I really appreciate having him in the conversations as well.
When you have a somewhat non-technical co-founder, though, do you get into situations where, hey, the requirement was just a sentence? Like, I gave you the business requirement. Why is this 10,000 lines of code?
Yes, absolutely. And there are times when I think Courtney asks me, well, can't we just do this? And I'm like, okay. So first of all, we have to talk a little bit more granular level about, can it just do this? Like, okay, we have to talk like, you know, it has to be really detailed about like everything. So he's learning like how detailed, we've started to like write user stories together and he's learning how detailed they need to be, so that we prevent any back and forth, that happens.
Hey folks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Raygun and their new product called Pulse. Raygun is an error and crash reporting software provider, and their new product, Pulse, it's a real-time user monitoring product. It gives you performance data and user insights, lets you understand exactly what's happening when users interact with your software, so you're never left guessing. Raygun provides you with the answers to your performance questions, and they've found over 10 billion, that's billion with a B, bugs in customer apps with their crash reporting product, And now Raygun will help you understand application quality like no one else. Over 30,000 developers worldwide can't be wrong. I use Raygun all the time and I enjoy it very much. You can try it out today with a no-risk 30-day free trial. Start improving your software quality immediately. Try Raygun for free today at raygun.io. Yeah, sometimes I think that non-technical co-founders or not as technical co-founders kind of forget that there's this table that we, the developers, have in our minds about like all the browsers and all the platforms. And they might say something, a little throwaway sentence. Mm-hmm. And then in your mind, you're like, oh, but what about Safari on old Macs? That's probably, you know, do we care about those people? And then it becomes a whole snowball.
Yep.
So you are a small team, but you're going to grow. You've taken some investment. At this point, you're making architectural decisions. You're making technical decisions. But I'm assuming also you don't want to build all the stuff yourself. Like if there's a great technology, you're using it. So you mentioned WebRTC.
Yes.
Is that something that you'll pick over, you know, just YouTube and something like that?
Yes. So when we, as I mentioned, when we started, we were using the Google Hangouts infrastructure. And we knew that in order for us to build something sustainable, we had to find a way to move off of the Google Hangouts infrastructure.
In the sense that you don't want to build a business that is entirely dependent on Hangouts?
Correct. Yep. And so WebRTC is a library. It's a library framework that allows in-browser real-time communication. There's open source versions of it, and then a lot of folks who offer their own special API.
There's no plugin, right? That's because you mentioned before that having to download stuff was going to be a problem for your attendees.
Correct. And so one of the things that's big, huge value for us is accessibility and inclusion, which includes like device type and bandwidth and all of that. We felt like to create an inclusive tool, we needed something that was 100% in browser, and the WebRTC libraries allows that.
So that means then modern browsers, somewhat modern, mm-hmm. right? The last couple of years,
yep,
reasonably modern portable devices and things like that. But for the general person who wants to show up, they roll in, they've got Chrome, they've got Firefox, they've got Edge or a new tablet, and there's no download, there's no anything like that.
Yep.
How many open source libraries have you brought in? Like, do you, off the top of your head, is there a particular library that stands out and you're like, oh, without foo.js, this project would have been more difficult?
Yeah. So we use OpenTalk, which is API library for WebRTC, and that's been really huge for us. I think there are other libraries. So one of the things that we're really interested in right now is using Twitter as an engagement tool. And so we've been playing with different Twitter libraries.
In order to abstract away the complexities of Twitter itself.
Yep. Yep.
So you said just for folks that are listening, since this is a podcast, Open Talk is Open T O K.
Correct.
Not T-A-L-K.
Yep.
And this is a library that sits on top, but it's also a series of services that sits on top of WebRTC.
Yep.
But this puts you in control. And I think what's significant about this is that you could have built this on Hangouts and, you know, like I do a weekly community stand-up, and, you know, we're not a company. We're just doing this for work.
Sure.
And we've hidden it all with JavaScript and, but it's Google Hangouts and it's embedded YouTube.
Yep.
But, you know, my YouTube channel could get deleted.
Yep.
You know, I'm going to lose all that intellectual property.
We actually had an issue like that with one of our conferences. It was awful.
Really?
Yeah. So, we're all about kind of the experience of the user. And, we decided that in between sessions, we should have music. We played like, it was copywritten music, and YouTube took down all 5 hours of our conference.
Oh, no. Did you like get it back?
Or? We were able to hack together. I mean, it took us several hours of work to recover it, but that was a lesson learned. And we were like, okay, then we have to get off of Google Hangouts. But
Right. And that is such a challenge for startups because you want to sit on a mature platform and use some software as a service. But if you don't control your bytes, then you get nailed.
Yep.
So you're building more stuff yourself. You're building it on, you said Groovy on Grails. Where do you do your hosting? Are you hosting yourself? Are you going at Amazon or Azure?
Yeah. So we're having a Heroku AWS fight right now.
What does that mean? A fight?
Heroku was cheaper, but it crashes. So we're playing with different configuration on both Heroku and AWS to figure out what we can do for the cheapest. Shout out to you for, helping us get in BizSpark. The hosting on Azure, for our video has been huge.
So you're using the media stuff on Azure?
We are. Yep.
Oh, interesting. So I think what's significant about this, and I appreciate that. I'm not trying to sell Azure, but I think what's interesting is that even with two people and a small business, you're a multi-cloud company.
Yes.
And that I'm hearing that more and more. People aren't going all in on one cloud because you might need to move at any time.
Yes, absolutely.
Was that an obvious decision or did that just happen?
I think initially we were kind of like, what do we have familiarity with as individuals, and then what's the cheapest?
If you can get free free credits or whatever, I'm sure all of the clouds have a startup feature.
Yep.
Has licensing of things been difficult at all? I know that small companies, when they start bringing in open source libraries, they'll say, "Oh, well, this is GPL'd," or "Oh, this is Apache," and I want to use this, and I don't want to use that.
Yeah, we haven't at all. It may be something that we run into, but it hasn't been an issue thus far.
And what about security? As an enterprise developer, I remember that I had a whole security team.
Yes.
You know, so I thought about it, but I didn't think about it.
Well, so as of this past month, Chrome no longer allows WebRTC streams unless you have an SSL certificate. And so that was something new. So we were like, okay, we were moving in that direction to make sure that everything was secure anyway. But then as of December, we had to... it's definitely something that we're still working out and thinking through.
So I think that's a really interesting thing to dig into a little bit. Like someone might be listening and thinking, well, that's obvious. They should have an SSL certificate. But when you're an enterprise software developer, that's edge. Like that's handled. Mm-hmm. Like someone else registers the domain.
Yep.
Someone else gets the certs.
Yep.
You don't think about that.
Yep. Right? Yeah. I mean, all of these really things, these things that they're like no-brainers. But they're like no-brainers for the people who spend all day thinking about them and not also all the other stuff like getting customers and making sure contractors are paid and that our app doesn't crash. And yeah.
Well, that was my next question. So how much time are you actually spending doing the technology and the coding you love versus all the administrivia?
Yeah, not.
You're shaking your head.
Not a lot. It's difficult. I don't get to spend nearly enough time geeking out, and I'm trying to do a better job of because one of the things that really makes me nervous now, it makes me nervous for there to be any part of my application that I don't understand well.
Oh no.
I know.
But you know that's going to happen.
I know.
No, I'm totally with you. Like there's a moment where it's like, when I'm raising, you know, two boys and I think it was maybe in the last month or two where I'm like, wow, they have whole lives and like friends and opinions that I did not put in their brains.
I know.
And I don't fully understand them anymore. It's like your program where you don't really understand. It works.
Yeah.
But I don't know how.
Right. I know. And then it's like, you don't really know what to expect. And then like,
So at some point you either need to go all in and don't be CEO, be CTO.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Or you just declare, like you hear this a lot, well, I used to be technical.
I know.
You know, but then I started a business.
I know. It's something.
Have you thought about that?
It definitely is. If I had my way, I don't know if I should publicly say this, but I'm well anywhere. I would be CTO. That's where I want to be. Mm. I also know that as founder, the vision is really important. And I don't know that I am ready to give up that vision. We're not mature enough yet for me to like let somebody else take the reins of that. So,
yeah, that is the challenge with all these things. And I can also say though, as someone who has a small startup, much, much smaller, that, maybe we made the mistake of having two technical people.
Hmm.
You know, I've got I've got two Wozniaks and yeah. I have no, you know, I have no passion person.
Yep.
And we just thought that it would light the world on fire because it was amazing.
Yep. You just built something cool.
And it's so cool, but no one cares.
Yeah.
That has got to be a real challenge. Is it difficult to divide the work? Is it clear what you and what Courtney does? Are you always just hustling?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, in the very beginning months, it was difficult because we didn't really have a real product. And so we were like trying to figure out, who are we? What do we do? What do we sell? And at that point, it was kind of difficult. And we were doing like daily check-ins at that point, like daily hourly calls of like working sessions to kind of figure it out. But then once we get a little bit more mature and we had an actual product to sell, we were able to divide responsibilities. So yeah.
And at this point, it's very clear what how to handle things.
It's clearer. I don't know if it's very clear. Yeah, well, I mean, one of the things that I know we do really, really well is we're both dreamers and visionaries and big picture people. Mm-hmm. When you're running a startup, both of the founders can't be, you need somebody who's like big picture, mm-hmm. And somebody who's like tactical, like we've got to get stuff done. And I think we do a good job of like going back and forth and allowing us both to be able to play the dreamer.
Do you feel like two is the team size? Like that's the start, like every startup should have two? Because I've heard of like five pre-person startups, that and I've heard of one person trying to do it on their own.
I think five would be intense, although, yeah. So one, when Courtney and I met, we met, I co-organized, TransHack Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I was at Dev Bootcamp, helped Dev Bootcamp launch a Chicago location. That's how I met Courtney. And we had an opportunity. What was cool is we had an opportunity to meet over a hackathon weekend. So we had like 5 days to work together and actually produce something. And
no, that's a really good point. Actually, mm-hmm. Let me just interrupt because to have a hackathon is almost an interview process or like a first date.
Yes.
For a founder is a great idea.
I really appreciated that. I'm having that experience. And one of the things we were like, late at night and we were talking and one of the things that Courtney said is like, yeah, the business part is kind of easy. It's really just the emotional part that you need someone else there for. And that was the moment I was like, oh, maybe we should work together. Because we were really smart and shared values and, a lot of things that you need to work with someone. The point just being that like, the emotional piece of having someone else to talk to when you're right before you're getting ready to go into a really big sales call or, having someone else to talk to when like you create something and nobody buys it and you're like feeling like crap. I don't know. I know for sure that we would not, I would not be on this journey if I didn't have a partner in it. Mm-hmm. At least one partner in it.
Yeah. You know, I've always been surprised when I see amazing work done by single individuals. And you go on Hacker News and you're like, oh, I built a Commodore 64 emulator in JavaScript in my basement all alone. You know, it's like, really, you just locked yourself in there. Like, I have to walk around mm-hmm. and talk to people. Mm-hmm. I got to go to Starbucks and talk to random strangers and say, what do you think about this?
Yep.
When I was an enterprise developer, I was always wandering into other people's mm-hmm. cubes. Yep. Just because I want to be there. I mean, I've always found coding is a social experiment.
Absolutely.
It's a social thing.
It's absolutely. And so, yeah, right now I'm like the most isolated I've ever been in my life and it's kind of dangerous. Something to talk about, just like isolation of startup founders. I spend a lot of time alone. and it's crazy. And it, especially so my co-founder lives 2,000 miles away from me. So we're completely virtual.
I can relate. I work remotely. Like, I'm here and, you know, I can see your closet.
Yep.
You can see my closet and my couch, right? We're having this discussion over Skype and I'm kind of lonely right now, you know, and I'm actually going to drive up to Seattle to go and hang out with my coworkers tomorrow because it's just driving me nuts. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been too long. Do you go to meetups? What do you do as a technical co-founder
it's tough.
Get that injection of?
Yeah. And then, so I also have this thing that like, I'm a black woman, which means that oftentimes, even though I've been a developer for 10 years, you know, I have to like prove my credibility over and over again, which gets exhausting at times. I want to talk about like geek stuff and like people assume that I'm there to like serve coffee like over and over and over again, which is exhausting and annoying. And I think you learn just ways to deal with it. I am lucky in that so when I learned to code, I learned to code at an organization called IC Stars. It's a nonprofit in Chicago that does, basically they teach people who are interested in technology to build applications, web-based applications for community-based organizations in their area. So there's a whole network and, community of, like-minded folks who are geeks for what it enables. And not necessarily like, I mean, I have nothing against like geeks who are just geeks because tech is cool, but I'm really excited about like, what are the, you know, real life use case scenarios, and how we can like change people's lives. And that's what I get excited about. And so I am lucky in that I do have a community of folks who are like-minded.
That's really cool. I think it's so important. And I think the listeners should really think about this. There's so many aspects to our identity, you know?
Yep.
There's the obvious outward stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's the inner stuff you can't see, yep, whether it be diseases or backgrounds, yep, or whatever. And you got to find your tribe, don't, mm-hmm, you?
Absolutely.
Like whoever your tribe is. It could be civic-minded coders.
Yep.
It could be people who are diabetic,
yep,
or wounded veterans or whatever. Or maybe intersectionally, you are all of those things.
Yep.
And it's really freaking cool, mm-hmm, to see somebody who's like you.
Yep.
And it just clicks.
Yep. It's super affirming. Sometimes you talk about the isolation. Sometimes you're like, am I crazy? Am I the only one who thinks these crazy thoughts? Am I the only one who spends hours like trying to figure out these hacks? And then you meet people who are like you. And it's really, really affirming.
Mm-hmm. And I find being a remote that the imposter syndrome becomes even greater.
Yes.
Because the voices in your head, for, yes, lack of a better word, are louder when you're by yourself.
Yep.
And it's just nice to have someone tell you.
Yep. They have more space and time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is great. You're doing some really exciting stuff. And where can people follow you on Twitter and hear about what you're doing?
Sure. So on Twitter, I'm Michael Solution, M-I-K-E-L-L Solution. Our website is bsmdot.co, bsm.co. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, we'll make sure to put those in the show notes so people can link directly to them from the website. Tiffany Michael, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott. It was a pleasure.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.